I'm Cara, for those of you who don't know. I've been facilitating the Young People's Group at this centre for about 2 years, alongside other people. At the moment, it's Matt and Dharma Sharlin I have the pleasure of working with. But other sort of facilitators have come and gone in that time, and the group's changed quite a lot over that time as well. We've seen it grow, we've seen it shrink, we've seen big bursts of enthusiasm and then big drops of enthusiasm. And I'm sort of like what Federici was saying earlier, the fact that we're together enough now to be putting on a day like this is a really good sign. And I'm just really glad to be here. I'm really appreciative of this opportunity to be here and just to be listening to what everybody's saying about gratitude and how the Sangha really affects their lives. And I found that last session really moving, actually. The young people's movement has grown from the last few years. It was set up. It's gone from like 30 people, I think, in the Bilbury Hill Centre down the road, to now we have yearly young people's events. There's a big one in October. We get like 150 young people all together in this mad, like Hogwarts-style boarding school, and create something that's kind of a cross between a massive house party, Harry Potter, and sort of a retreat as well. And there's just so much energy in that, and so much enthusiasm and positivity in that, that it just shows it's a really sort of thriving movement and much needed as well, and for reasons that I'll sort of go into. So as part of my, as a young person's facilitator, other facilitators around the country in Sri Ratna centres, we form a kula, and we meet up a couple of times a year to talk about, to share ideas and inspiration and sort of check in with how things are going in our centres. And we met a few weeks ago, and I was asked to give a talk about sort of how being a facilitator challenges me and inspires me and deepens my going for refuge. And what I talked about in terms of inspiration was that what really inspires me about being a facilitator and being part of this movement is that we're creating something, we're creating this alternative culture for young people, which is, as Lucinda has really sort of wonderfully and humorously evoked, is much needed. Like youth culture out there, it doesn't really offer an awful lot. It's quite a spiritually barren land and very superficial. And the fact that we're creating something so positive and so radically different, and seeing the effects that has on people is a massive source of inspiration for me, and helps me to go deeper in my own practice and gives me faith and confidence that the Buddha's teachings are real and they work and they're of value and they're worth communicating. When we were putting together the programme for this talk, we were, Dharma Sharlin brought up this quote of Sangharakshita's about how when people come to visit him, they often express the gratitude for him setting up the movement, and they often say that it's his clarity of presentation of the Dharma that they appreciate, and also the sort of positive alternative culture that the Sangha provides for them. So we're putting it together, and Viduichi's got this talk about his latest thinking. And I was like, oh yeah, well, I've got that talk about the alternative culture, yeah, slot that in, that'd be fine. Didn't really think it through that meant I'd actually have to give a talk here today. And the fact that was only 5 minutes of my talk before, and I'm now meant to be talking for half an hour. So I basically had to write a completely new talk, and I've written it about six times yesterday. So my notes are a bit scattered, and I'm going to be jumping around a lot, so hopefully there's going to be some sort of coherent structure in that. I actually tried to rewrite it about an hour ago and just thought, oh, yeah. we'll see how I get on. If we're talking about Sangha as an alternative culture, I thought it worth starting off by sort of exploring a little bit, well, what are we creating an alternative to, and why is that needed? So what we're creating alternative to is essentially modern Western society, certainly in the West where we're practicing. I find it quite interesting that in the Sangha we talk quite a lot about modern society, Western society, but what we're actually talking about is capitalist society. Modern Western societies are all based on a capitalist socio-economic structure. And that society that we talk about is created by that socio-economic system. So I thought it worth just briefly and sort of going into a little bit about what is that, you know, what does that really mean? Because it's interesting that we don't use that word. And I think that, you know, what people have said to me when I sort of bring that up is like, well, I don't really understand what capitalism means. I don't really, you know, can't really engage with that. It's some sort of weird, abstruse political thing, and we're not political. We just want to, you know, have a spiritual practice. So I'm going to sort of try to briefly explain a little bit about what that is, and then sort of talk about why that presents us with particularly challenging conditions to be practicing in. And I'm going to offer a health warning at this point because, as Lucinda said, like I'm heavily involved in activism, and a lot of that is anti-capitalist activism. And for reasons that I hope will become clear, like why I am trying to challenge capitalism and to sort of change it and essentially overthrow it. But yeah, so if I start ranting and getting a bit too much on that side, just someone throw something at me. Because I could talk about it for a long time, and I sort of what I want to, you know, I want to focus on the positive, but there's also a lot to say in order to sort of bring about a, for us to be able to clearly make a comparison between capitalist society and the Sangha here, which are completely opposite as far as I see it. So fairly briefly, what capitalism is, according to my Routledge political dictionary. Is essentially a socio-economic system in which there's a free and competitive market, free meaning unregulated by the government, by the state, particularly with neoliberal capitalism. So a free and competitive market in which entrepreneurs hire labourers at the minimum possible cost to produce the maximum possible output at the cheapest possible price for their own private gain. So the ultimate aim of the capitalist is profit, essentially. And what happens in this situation is it essentially creates a profit at all costs situation. So profit becomes more important than the welfare of the workers, becomes more important than any damage to the environment or society that's sustained in the pursuit of that profit. And often the problem with this model is that it inherently creates an inequality. So, especially since the 1980s and the rise of neoliberal economics, which is kind of capitalism extreme of sort of like truly unregulated economies. So it's a really deregulated free market in which the idea being that the wealth trickles down from the very top of society, the most rich people, the most powerful people that are operating things, that it trickles down to the masses. That's the idea. But as we've seen over the last 30 years or so, the reality is that it only trickles down one or two layers, and the rest of society don't benefit quite so much as quite a small majority. And we're really, this is like particularly important and prevalent at this time at the moment, where we're seeing the absolute dismantling of the welfare state, privatisation of a lot of public sector stuff, privatisation of everything from like education to the health service and everything else. So it's a really sort of important current issue, I think, to be sort of looking at. And the sort of austerity agenda that we're seeing sort of wreaking havoc in Europe, look at Spain, Greece, Cyprus, like countries on their knees because of these neoliberal policies. And it's interesting to note that austerity has never ever worked wherever it's been applied, be that in Asia, Africa, South America, Europe, it's never worked. So it's a really sort of obviously flawed system. And what happens in an unregulated market is that essentially industries become monopolised. Competitors sort of swallow up all the smaller competitors that can't compete. And again, placing the majority of wealth in the hands of very few, with the rest of the people left relatively powerless. And the other thing about capitalism is that it's essentially based on capital. Capital meaning money being used to earn more money. So people lend money to people to earn more money from the interest, and people borrow money to earn money to make more money. So it creates this sort of situation of you can never have too much, like profit, you know, companies can never be profitable enough, people can never consume enough. So that has an impact upon us psychologically, of like we can never have enough. So it's this this sort of craving, this sort of discontent that sort of is that brings about, which also creates a pressure for a sort of continuous growth, infinite growth, a continual stimulation of demand and consumerism to keep the economy going. But obviously that's not possible on a planet with finite resources. So it's not sustainable, and we're seeing it crashing spectacularly globally within countries, and our sort of inability to respond to the accelerating climate change because of the vested interests of the corporate state complex, which essentially controls these economies, is sort of testament to that sort of carrying out. So essentially, it's a system that's based in greed, and in fact, it rewards and encourages greed and selfishness and individualism and competitiveness, all of which are obviously challenges for us as spiritual practitioners trying to cultivate the opposite of these things. We're trying to practice in conditions that are essentially perpetuating greed, hatred and delusion, and the suffering that kind of goes with that, the existential suffering of being conditioned by these ideas in a society that is very greed-based, very self-oriented, very individualistic, very competitive, and also the sort of actual physical suffering of people that the system doesn't favour. So people in poverty, inequality is rising. We're seeing throughout the world inequality is increasing. So there's more and more people that are in poverty because of this, and more people becoming very rich because of this. So it's clear that we need a new vision of human possibility in the West, what it means to be human. And I think that Buddhism really has a lot to offer that in terms of creating an alternative culture to that. And Subhuti, in his Buddhist manifesto, if you haven't read this, I really recommend it. He summed this up quite succinctly and quite articulately. He says that the way of life in rich countries, which people in emerging economies understandably aspire and are rapidly gaining access, is the major driver of our environmental problems and of much geopolitical tension. Modern economies, i.e. capitalist economies, depend upon increasing consumer demand to drive economic growth, and that growth requires the use of more energy and resources, which in turn leads to more climate change and carbon use and more tension-building competition for scarce commodities. Buddhists can demonstrate a genuinely alternative way of life that lives lightly on the planet and that is more truly satisfying than the deliberately stimulated discontent that is the fundamental basis of our present system. So what I find really interesting is this kind of juxtaposition between capitalism and the capitalist society and Sangha and the Buddhist society. Because if you look at the sort of characteristics or principles of a capitalist society, a modern Western society, we see on this hand greed and selfishness and private ownership. And yet in the Sangha we're trying to practice generosity. We see in capitalism this idea of exponential growth, craving, there's never quite enough, and yet we're trying to practice contentment. We see competitiveness and individualism based on the delusion that our ego selves are separate from other ego selves, so we must compete with them. And yet we're trying to gain insight into the true nature of the self, that we're not separate, and trying to practice kindness and cooperation within the Sangha. We see in capitalism inequality and disproportionate power on wealth, power in the hands of very few, and yet we're trying to understand connectedness and that everybody has an equal spiritual potential for growth. And then looking at the lifestyle then that brings about, a sort of modern Western lifestyle is over busy. These things in terms of lifestyle, we can compare them with the precepts that we're trying to practice as Buddhists. So the over busyness sort of contradicts the contentment and the simplicity that we're trying to practice with that precept. In the sort of modern usual lifestyle, we've got superficiality, the gossip media, Lindsay Lohan's hairstyle, propaganda in the press, and this sort of consumerist media. And yet we're trying to practice truthful, deep and honest communication. We've got the materialism as well, and yet we're trying to practice generosity again. And then the escapism as well of like media, Facebook, shopping, binge drinking, and we're trying to practice mindfulness. So this is why I'm an anti-capitalist. It's because it seems that if you are going to invent a socio-economic system and everything that that brings about, that was completely the opposite of Dharma, that completely undermined everything the Buddha was saying, it would be capitalism. And that is why I'm so involved in political activism, is because I think that, yeah, I would question whether enlightenment is possible in a capitalist society. And I think that there's a lot of work to be done to sort of work from both ends of it, like, yes, to be creating Sangha, and yes, to be sort of working on ourselves and working on greed, hatred and delusion in our own selves, but then also to be sort of looking at the conditions that we're operating in and sort of attacking it from that angle as well, and trying to challenge those things in society. And all of this, I think, has particular reference to young people. Young people today are sort of, I think, they're more sensitive to these pressures in society. You know, you're a young person, you're coming out into the world and you're thinking, right, what am I going to do with my life? How am I going to live my life? What does society have to offer me? What do people do? Okay, people get a job, they get a career, they get promoted, then they get a partner, and then they get a house, and then they have babies, and it's sort of this treadmill that we sort of go along. And it's interesting to find that, like, when I got involved in Buddhism a few years ago, a lot of my friends, like old drinking buddies, were like, what? Buddhism? What? And now, having sort of been through that system a little bit themselves, and they've got the job, and they've got the partner, and they're all buying houses, they're all like, so Carl, what, that Buddhism thing? Like, what's that about then? It's like, oh, right, yeah, okay. That's quite interesting. If we sort of look at what modern youth culture offers young people, essentially it sort of invites people, to come and get wasted. Like, there's this sort of hedonism, like happiness is in hedonism. It's all about having fun. You need to have fun to sort of escape the sort of drudgery of your sort of working, you know, your working life. Like Marx talked about alienation, and this sort of, not having control over the things that you're producing and all of that. And there's this sort of, escapism and hedonism as a response to that. And sort of how people, I noticed this sort of like culture of banter in youth culture among young people, of sort of essentially just taking the piss out of each other, and sort of, it just seems like, like passive aggressiveness that's based in insecurity. And there's this sort of pressure to sort of like to be someone, to be beautiful, to be cool, to be like fashionable or thin or whatever it is. And then to have all of these things as well, like the, you know, the house, the career, everything else. And we're sort of seeing, you know, like the riots a few years ago were sort of a real sort of a really powerful message of just how kind of helpless young people feel these days. You know, we've got increasingly expensive education with no guarantee of a job at the end of it. It's people feel a bit hopeless, I think. So with the young people's group, it's kind of, we're offering something really quite radically different to what is offered to people in society at the moment. Sort of last year, I was reflecting a little bit about, you know, what does our young people's group really exist for? The conclusion that I came to was it's not to hand the Dharma to people on a plate. It can get that very well at the Buddhist Centre. We're absolutely blessed to have amazing Dharma teachers here that can do that really amazingly well. What it is that certainly I want to offer people is friendship, is Sangha, is an alternative place that they can come to, and sort of get some sort of refuge from that. What it is that we're saying is saying come and cultivate awareness. Don't destroy it with drink and drugs. Come and actively cultivate awareness. Come and, you know, listen to each other deeply, appreciate each other, rejoice in each other's merits. Really sort of like deeply and honestly express yourself. And the only person that you have to be is yourself, with all of your confusions and all of your faults and all of your your strengths and your beauties as well, and whatever it is, like, you can bring that, and that's okay. And, you know, that really came out in the sort of little session we had just now. Like so many people said, there's no judgment in that. It's kind of like you just come as you are, and it's okay. And also sort of trying to see through this this kind of consumerist culture, and trying to see something a bit deeper, like seeing success beyond the ways that it's normally measured, and seeing value in things like beauty and simplicity and deep communication, shared values and authenticity. And this is what it is that inspires me about it. This is what I'm grateful for, because the experience that I've had of being involved with the Sangha, it wasn't until I met other young, cool, fun-loving people who were into meditation that I felt I could really integrate my Buddhist life into the rest of my life, rather than coming to the Buddhist centre in the week and hanging out with very lovely but much older than me Buddhists. But I still needed that peer contact, so I go out at the weekend with my friends and get wasted. And it was just this massive split between my Buddhist life and my social life. And it wasn't until I sort of had that contact with other young people that I was really able to fully embrace the Buddhist life and to think, no, I can do this, and I want to do this, and this is possible, and actually this is amazing. So I sort of really appreciate that, and sort of what Dharma Charlene was saying about kind of appreciation turning into gratitude, turning into conviction. I have a really strong conviction that I want to share this with other young people, because I see the benefits that it has on people. I see people flowering and growing and expressing so much kind of positive emotion and seeing the effect that it has on them. And that's kind of what inspires me. So in a sense, kind of what we're doing with the young people's group is, on one level, it might seem quite ordinary, it might seem quite unremarkable. Like, essentially what we do is sit around and with our eyes closed, and we chat a bit, and we drink some tea, we chat some more, we drink some more tea. You know, I can see why a lot of my friends might think, well, what, you know, I'd rather go out and have fun and get wasted. But in a sense, yeah, it might be quite unremarkable, but in another sense, it's actually really quite radical, and really quite amazing and inspiring. And yeah, it's kind of like radical tea drinking. We've talked a lot about tea today, so massive appreciation for tea. And but yeah, what we're actually doing is kind of flying in the face of that mass culture and really subverting that sort of greed, hatred and delusion that is so pervasive in society, and that is perpetuated and encouraged by the socio-economic system that we find ourselves in. Offering something much more meaningful for people. You know, so many people have talked about, you know, the Dharma's given me meaning in my life, it's given me purpose in my life, it's given me confidence, it's given me all of these things. I'm talking specifically about young people, the young people's movement and youth culture and society, but I think that what I'm saying is equally as applicable to Sangha on the whole, and society as a whole. You can sort of extrapolate it up and it works just as well. So Subhuti, in, again, referring to the manifesto, I've got so many different notes and tags. He talks about, he calls for a new style of Buddhist monasticism, based on the principles of the Buddha's own way of life, but in accordance with modern circumstances, sorry. And he calls for what he calls sutra-style monasticism. And I'm not going to go massively into that, but I thought it interesting to just sort of bring out the principles that he talks about in that, and how they sort of contradict with capitalist society and the capitalist lifestyle, and sort of highlight how these things are antidotes, and these things are really things that we can, really positive things that we can be aspiring to bring about really positive change in our lives. So the first principle he talks about is chastity, or brahmacharya. Obviously we're not suggesting that everybody needs to be celibate. In fact, most order members aren't. Some are. They choose that. lifestyle sort of often later on after they've been practicing for a while. But I think it's more kind of the spirit of this that's important and relevant for young people and for most people who are practicing fairly seriously. It's kind of just being aware of the effects of craving in particular, not just it's not just kind of abstention from sexual activity. It's Sabiti describes it as a highly positive state of freedom from craving. So it's kind of letting go of looking for security in anything that's not going to give it, sex being sort of like quite a big one, the whole romantic myth that there's somebody out there that is going to save us and kind of make us all better and make us happy. The other principles he talks about are fewness of possessions, simplicity of lifestyle, careerlessness, and community living. And there's an obvious kind of a contradiction to sort of the modern lifestyle in which we're materialistic and have a busy lifestyle, very sort of career driven, and sort of urban life for many over the world is now often lonely and socially fragmented, whereas community living is obviously the complete opposite of that. So what does Buddhism have to offer modern society? Well, a renewed Buddhism needs to offer an alternative culture and social life in the way that I've described, because culture shapes consciousness. And I think that's a really key point. Culture shapes consciousness. The conditions that we're operating in has an effect on us. I think it's Vidurici who picked up on this, saying that, well, yes, there's the karma nirma that we're operating in, but that there are other forces acting on us as well, other levels on which conditionality operates. And the society that we find ourselves in is one of those things. So the way that I see it is that we have, the Sangha has two key responsibilities today, particularly Triratna Sangha as a modern Buddhist movement in the West that's really trying to create a spiritual movement that's relevant and applicable to modern Western culture. That's kind of, you know, Bhante's vision in a sense. So the first responsibility that I think we have is sort of what we're doing really well already, actually, is creating a nucleus of ideal conditions to practice in. So we've got our centres, we've got our communities, we've got right livelihoods, and we really are providing a really positive alternative culture. But I also think that we have a responsibility to be actively working to change those conditions that we find ourselves in. I don't think that people are inherently good or evil or inherently generous or selfish. They're dependent upon conditions. And if we're operating in conditions that discourage things like generosity, things like compassion and cooperation, and actually encourage more negative states of mind, then we have a responsibility to try to be changing that and challenging that. Yeah. Where's next? Page 39. A bit all over the place. I've lost myself. So, yeah, again referring to Sabuti and his Buddhist Manifesto. He says, a renewed Buddhism needs to recognise the nature of society and its own role within it. Even a good constitution and new laws can be corrupted by a bad society. It's the values of the majority of citizens that are the real determiners of the worth of society. A just and free society arises because citizens generally value justice and freedom and will themselves act on the basis without the coercion of the law. And while I think that is true, I think that it's also true to say that it's more likely that these values like justice, freedom, equality, generosity are more likely to exist in a system where they're encouraged and rewarded and valued. And I think that this is what Buddhism has to offer. We can create a more values-based society. There needs to be a larger vision of human existence that animates the democratic process, a vision of the common good in terms that are more than merely material. This the Dharma offers supremely, and it does it basing itself not on belief in revelation or authority, but on an analysis of the nature of life is accessible to reason and can be confirmed in experience. The Dharma breathes the spirit of the age and gives its best expression. It is our duty to make the Dharma heard. So I hope I haven't focused too much on kind of negative stuff there. My intention is really to sort of highlight the fact that we are working in very challenging conditions, and personally I try to challenge and change those conditions on that scale, but also to be sort of working within the Sangha as well and working on ourselves and doing this too. So I just want to sort of end by saying, by really celebrating what we're doing already, and say that what we're doing is really amazing and really radical, and it's needed more than ever, and it's highly positive, and that we should really celebrate what it is that we're doing. And I think that sort of what we've heard from people today is testament to that. You know, people have expressed so much appreciation and so much gratitude, and have said sort of how much of a big effect, a transformative effect that it's had on people's lives. And if from that basis we can then go out and act and work to change things, and we are all in our own ways changing things and challenging sort of modern views that are in society. I think that we should be really proud of everything that Tree Ratna has achieved so far. We've achieved a lot. And especially for Bhante's radicalism and all of its fruits and everything that that's kind of brought about. The world needs the Dharma, basically, more than ever. So let's keep doing what we're doing and keep learning from it and growing from it, because the world really needs it. And let's also up our game and get out there and start to engage with the socio-political context that we find ourselves in, and try to transform and evolve the Dharma into something that is applicable to the situation that we find ourselves in, into a culturally relevant, truly socially engaged movement, because little by little, one cup of tea at a time, I think we are making the world a better place.
Very interesting the way that